All right, so the headline reads, have several headlines here. You know, one is press release, Congress to investigate Earth First bombing case. Congress of the United States letterhead to Dan Hamburg from Don Edwards, chairman of the Subcommittee on Civil and Constitutional Rights. Headline, Santa Rosa Press, Mike Janella, FBI won't open files on bombing. So we're going to get into the background, the whereases on that, and actually show the photographs live at 11 o'clock, an hour and a half from now, on Channel 3, with that tape and those photographs to be played back. There'll actually be photographs of the bombed automobile with the crater, the hole, the damage done by the bomb that was in the car back in 1989, a couple weeks before Redwood Summer. Judy Berry and Earl Cherney were down in Oakland. We'll cover all of that. But before we do, let's jump over to Idaho and get an update there. I did a little bit of an analysis earlier.
I was listening.
So you pick it up and let's go, because sometimes people get the idea the only real action is happening here. And what's going on there dwarfs what's happened here.
Well, I wouldn't say that. It wasn't as big as Redwood Summer, for example, but it was a tremendously courageous action for people to go into this hostile area in Idaho and try to defend the last roadless area, the largest roadless area in the United States. And it's not true that Earth First bought a plot of land. An individual who works with Earth First bought a plot of land. We don't have that kind of money. We kind of a shoestring organization.
Cindy Mayfield shaking her nuts.
She's ready
to subpoena the deed.
Sorry about that, Cindy, but anyway, no, this was an individual who bought a plot of land. And they tried to have a base camp there. And what they did was very similar to what we did during Redwood Summer. They called for people to come into the area and help them. They worked with locals as much as they could. And they held nonviolent blockades to try to stop road building in this last roadless area. And they had a strict nonviolence code that prohibited sabotage, that called for only nonviolence, to react to attacks only in nonviolent manners, and that's what they did all summer long in a very volatile area. One of the things that happened to them was a kind of a sabotage campaign of misinformation going out, and I don't know whether these events actually happened or not, but at two periods when they had big demonstrations planned, the day before the demonstrations or a couple days before the demonstrations, there would be an alleged act of sabotage discovered. So at one point they had a big demonstration planned, and the day before it came out that a bulldozer had been sabotaged. And nobody at the base camp or nobody associated with the action had anything to do with this, if it happened at all. But this was used to foment hostility in the area. So people went in and they did an amazing action. They buried themselves in a logging road up to their chest and got arrested blocking that logging road. Well, it was a really interesting legal scenario. This is very creative, and Cindy Mayfield and LP might want to listen in on this one, too. The blockaders who were buried in the logging road were arrested not for blocking a road. They were arrested for felony conspiracy to commit grand theft. And the theory behind that was that because they were blocking the logging road, they were preventing loggers from getting to work and earning money, and therefore it was grand theft, and since they conspired to do it, it was felony conspiracy. So they were held in jail for 18 days just for blocking a logging road. At another time when a large demonstration was planned, the day before that happened, the Forest Service claimed to have found tree spikes in an area nearby, and again, nobody having anything to do with the action had anything to do with that, and the entire action had a very strict nonviolence code calling for no activities of that kind. Again, this was used to foment hostility, and a man who was going to the base camp was ambushed and beat up, and the man turned out to be a third-generation local himself, but it was kind of this Earth First outsiders, you know, we're going to beat you up. So he was put in the hospital and, you know, hurt by being beaten up, but people still continue to stand up and to demonstrate. You talked about the health department coming on to the base camp.
Yeah, that's what I was just looking at. I got a quote from the... Go ahead, you tell.
Yeah, well, the health department, I wasn't going to elaborate on that one. I was going to say also the Fish and Wildlife, I believe it was, the government forestry agencies. Also, there was a campaign of harassing their base camp, of coming on to the base camp, and after the, you know, they tried to harass them about the sanitary conditions And I know that from the base camps that we keep, we really do our best. We do a lot better than a lot of towns, and certainly a lot better than a lot of dumps that I know about. At any rate, so the Forest Service, or actually I think it was Fish and Wildlife, came onto the base camp after the alleged tree spiking happened, and they did this raid in which they confiscated all their weapons, quote-unquote. They took their shovels. They took their firefighting equipment. They took their knives and forks from their cooking equipment. They took their hammers because, of course, that could be used to spike a tree. And they basically disarmed them of the kind of materials that you need to keep a sanitary camp in an area like that and to keep a safe camp. So, again, it was really just official harassment.
How many in the camp?
Well, it varied. It was, I'd say about, I think that, well, there was 40 people in the camp at the time of the raid, but it ranged from, say, 50 to 100 over the summer.
How far back in was it from a local road?
Oh, it's quite a mile. It's like, I think it's like 2 miles from a road, but it's quite a ways to the nearest towns and things like that. It's a very remote area, low population, and so...
I'm just trying to get to this harassment thing, and I don't have an angle on it one way or the other, but if you have 40 people back in, you're camping. The problem, according to U.S. Fish and Wildlife, was that the guy went there, and he said people were going out into the woods and taking a dump, which is what people do in a camp. I mean, you don't put it in your knapsack and carry it up the mountain with you. And that there was a gray water problem also, which it seems to me that is automatically a side effect of any type of camping activity. The incident is that if you have two people, then you have twice as much if it's one people, and if you have 40, you have what is expected in that situation? And didn't you kind of figure on that going in the door? I mean, I'm just wondering about the whole logistics involved.
I wasn't at that base camp, so I don't know how they did it. But I know that what we usually do here is if we have a lot of people, we'll even get porta-potties sometimes. But, certainly people do go out in the woods. I know this is a problem for Scott Butler and Albion, too. But
who's he?
He's a Louisiana Pacific Forester who complained about Earth Firsters relieving themselves in the woods, to which we respond, where do you go when you're out in the woods?
And where do the animals go?
Exactly. And if that doesn't have to be unsanitary at all. In fact, it's certainly more sanitary than dumping it in a stream. It's the way people have done it for eons, before toilets were invented. So I think that part of it is definitely harassment. Gray water has to be handled carefully, because it has grease and things like that don't degrade. So, you have to devise some kind of a filtering system for it. I don't really know what the system that they had there. I know they had Seeds of Peace up there, though, who worked with us at Redwood Summer, and they do an excellent job of maintaining base camp. So I doubt if there was any serious sanitary problems. And if they were worried about the safety of the camp, then what right did they have to confiscate their firefighting equipment, their shovels, the very things that they needed to keep a safe camp? I did want to go on, though, on the harassment, to the fact that at the end of the summer, a slap suit was filed against them, similar to the slap suit that was filed against us by Louisiana Pacific and Albion. And but in a way, it's even more outrageous. There's 100 John and Jane Does in that case, but I think there was something like 18 people that were named, and I think it was about 5 groups. And the groups included Ancient Forest Bus Brigade, who is the base camp support, one of the base camp support groups. And
let me just take a break here. FCC says, 1 minute past 9:30. This is KMFB FM, KPMO AM, broadcasting from Mendocino out to Mendocino County. And we have Judy Berry here this morning from Earth First. She's going to be talking about the bombing. Now we're talking about Earth First activities in Idaho. She will be live on Channel 3 at 11 o'clock, with that being replayed several times over the weekend. So that satisfies the FCC requirement to announce our call letters. Back to you, Judy. Go ahead.
Okay. So at any rate, at the end of the summer, a lawsuit, a slap suit was filed against the demonstrators. And they named all of these groups as well as individuals. I think they named 18 individuals. I'm not totally sure of that number, but it's something like that. And they named Earth First. They named the Earth First Direct Action Fund, the Earth First Journal. So several groups associated with Earth First. And they recently had their first hearing on this, and what they did in this case was they didn't serve the groups. In fact, they didn't even serve all the individuals. And so the groups that were sued didn't have any knowledge of the time of the hearing or the fact that a hearing was even being held, not having received any papers on it. Well, when they got to the hearing in this very hostile town in Idaho, the judge granted a summary judgment against the defendants, and what that means is they say, okay, well, you're not here, so we just default you. You lose the case. So they have already defaulted the SLAPP suit against several of these groups, Earth First Direct Action Fund, Earth First Journal, etc.
Question, though, so we get it straight because it's really important. If they take a judgment against you because you're not there, it's called a default, and you can very easily turn that over by coming up with a good excuse. Mm-hmm. A summary judgment is what it's called, is when that you file your answer, and even you may be there, but the judge says, this is such an overwhelmingly one-sided case, right. We're granting judgment. To overturn a motion for summary judgment, you have to go to the Court of Appeals. So one is really, really heavy duty.
I believe it's summary judgment. Okay. I believe it was a summary judgment that they granted that the companies, it was the Jippo company, just like they put Mantra Pardini up front in the LP suit. They did the same thing in Idaho. Although it's Forest Service interest, they put the small companies up as the plaintiffs. And they what they asked for a summary judgment. They said, you know, just rule this case against them. But since people hadn't been served, they hadn't prepared a defense, they weren't there to defend themselves, they didn't submit any briefs, the judge ruled against them first time, just immediately. Now, I believe this can be certainly overturned because you're required to be served before you can be sued. You have to know you're being sued before they can be holding proceedings against you. But if you look at what this does, before they even start, they have to hire a lawyer to overturn this first round of court hearings. So they've really put people in a bind. And then we have the other issue of, which we fought here, the existence of Earth First. That Earth First is not an organization, and it doesn't have officers, and it doesn't have appointed representatives to represent us in court. And so we've argued the issue here in the SLAPP suit as to whether Earth First is a suable as an organization, as opposed to individual people who may affiliate with Earth First. But is Earth First suable as an organization? And we've been battling that one here. Well, this really puts them in a bind because they've gotten a summary judgment against Earth First, who has never been served. Now, if somebody in the name of Earth First hires a lawyer to defend them and say, we were never served, then they are de facto admitting that they're a suable entity because they've sought the relief of the court by hiring a lawyer to defend them. If they ignore it, then the court can go ahead and try to seize their assets. So this move to grant this summary judgment without people being served is a lot worse harassment than it even looks on its surface, because it's forcing several groups to incorporate themselves in order to defend themselves and really adopt a structure that they didn't have before the suit started.
Who are the plaintiffs? Timber companies?
Yeah, small companies, not big corporations like LP, just small JIPO companies.
Okay, good report. Before we go into the bombing, in front of you is that press release. Again, we're announcing this because of the fact that it just came to the surface. Noon today, rally in front of the Sheriff's Department on behalf of several different entities. Let me read them because you're part of it, and I want to ask you your impression of this. But it's a rally for civil rights, stop bigots with badges, justice for Native Americans, Spanish-speaking peoples, environmental activists, all people of color are the groups. This is, again, noon at the Sheriff's Department today. We did try and get a hold of Sheriff Tussaud. He's on his way to Covelo and en route and therefore can't call in. He will try to be available tomorrow to give us a report. Margene McGee, who we interviewed earlier, is going to be there. She is one of the organizers, and she'll give us a report tomorrow morning. We have a call through to the Sheriff's Department now that if they have any representative that wants to come on the air and just give a general perspective as far as the rally is concerned from the Sheriff's Department standpoint, we will bring them right onto the air. Otherwise, we'll be doing that tomorrow morning. So again, that's today at noon. Mendocino County Civil Rights Protection League, Center for Environmental Justice, Friends of Albion Nation, Aboriginal Tribal Sovereignty, Native Support Network, Green Party of Mendocino County. Again, we've got Judy Berry here. She, again, will be live at Channel 3. So, environmental activists are part of this thing. Your perspective on it, and kind of a job is the sheriff doing?
Well, first of all, I'm surprised that Earth First isn't listed as a sponsor, because we were among the people at the original meeting when we talked about this problem of increased harassment of environmentalists. I was out of town when this rally was planned, unfortunately, and the people who planned it didn't know that I had already scheduled this with you this morning, so I'm going to have to rush over from the television to try to catch the end of the rally. I certainly support the rally. There are many people besides me who could have authorized Earth First, and I wish that they had, because certainly Earth First has been a recipient of this kind of treatment, and we certainly support any action to try to stop it. So I'll just add it right now. Let's add Earth First to the list of sponsors.
Okay. Do you perceive any different treatment of environmentalists than Native Americans? Is there similarity of prejudice? Or, I mean, are the Native Americans really a target more so than activists?
Very much so more than environmental activists. And I think this is not only local, but I think this goes nationwide, and it relates to what we're going to talk about concerning the bombing. The especially politically active Native Americans are very much targeted, especially during 1990 before the bombing. They began to treat Earth First kind of the way that Native people and people of color have always been treated. And I got a taste of it, and I know what it feels like.
What about Toussaint? Is he pretty fair? I mean, all things considered, given his position?
I don't know. I haven't seen him really go out of his way. I've heard a lot of words, but I haven't really seen much. I mean, Tony Craver is the one in Albion who was responsible for the police being so good and so on top of things. It wasn't particularly Toussaint. I haven't seen Toussaint willing to stick his neck out. But I think that Native people and, you know, the Spanish-speaking people, all, you know, any people of color, especially in this county, which is primarily white, are really subject to a different kind of treatment. There's a different standard. So that the fact that they would come into Margene's neighborhood and pull a gun on her and on her children or point a gun around her children, I don't think they would be so quick to do that in a white neighborhood. I certainly don't think they do it in West Ukiah as they would do it, you know, in a Native community. They kind of almost expect that stuff. And I think that this is not only local. I think it goes nationwide. And it, for example, this congressional committee you were referring to is investigating the FBI's behavior in the bombing of me, which is totally outrageous and should be investigated. But they should also be investigating Leonard Peltier and Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, who have at least equally outrageous scenarios with the same FBI agents. I share a lawyer with Geronimo, so I know that we've been trying to link the two cases with the Congress and get them to pay equal attention, and they won't. They're simply a double standard. So the treatment of environmentalists that we've gotten in this county is a tip of the iceberg of what people of color experience every day in their life.
Okay, then let's take it one step at a time. First of all, if we can, not everybody listening recalls or was living here or remembers the facts of the incident that sets off the rest of our conversation, that being the bombing in Oakland. Can you give us a 3-4 minute synopsis? Where were you going? What was going on? What happened? And the initial phase of the arrest, and then we'll get into the congressional investigation.
Sure.
And all of that. Which, by the way, you said it was outrageous. You meant the activity of the FBI was outrageous, not Congress looking into the file.
Yes.
You want the Congress to look into
it. No, Congress should be looking into the
file. Okay, all right, we want to make that clear.
Okay, at any rate, well, in 1990, we had called for Redwood Summer, called for people to come in from across the country to engage in nonviolent protests to stop the overcutting in the Redwood region. And I was receiving a series of increasingly frightening death threats before the bombing, you know, indicating that somebody was trying to kill me. And the Mendocino County Sheriff's Department, including Burl Murray, who's still there, he's still one of the people involved, refused to respond to both the threats and actual acts of violence against Earth Firsters. In fact, Burl Murray was sitting right there when I went to them about the death threats, and he said, "We don't have the manpower to investigate. If you turn up dead, then we'll investigate." So that'll give you an idea of how responsive our police department is.
Well, in fairness, though, I mean, isn't that not just Judy Berry, but if I went with a threat, they would say, "We cannot investigate threats."
Well,
I mean,
some
that's
of these were pretty...
That's what Susan Messini said.
Well, regardless, I don't know, but what I said at the time, I'll repeat it, if Chef Tucker from LP had received those threats, they would have declared martial law. So I think that there's a double standard. Anyway, so back to trying to do a capsule of this. I was driving through Oakland on the way to on an organizing tour for Redwood Summer when a bomb went off in my car, and it was hidden under my seat. I felt it rip through me. I know exactly where it was. And I was nearly killed by it, and I was taken to the hospital. Within minutes of the bombing, the FBI arrived on the scene, and rather than investigate this bombing or treat it like the obvious assassination attempt that it was, they declared that Daryl and I were the only suspects in the bombing, that it was our bomb and we were knowingly carrying it, and they arrested us. And for 8 weeks, they put out a slew of publicity nationwide. It's the only time I ever made the front page of the New York Times for bombing myself, allegedly, saying that these Earth Firsters were carrying this bomb and it accidentally blew up and we bombed ourselves. And they had all kinds of leaks and evidence that they kept putting out, but at the end of the 8 weeks, they were unable to come up with any evidence that would stand up in a court of law, and the Alameda County District Attorney declined to press charges. The FBI never removed me and Daryl from the suspect list, and they never conducted any legitimate investigation of anyone except for me and Daryl. And to this day, there's been no investigation, and the bomber remains at large.
They did heavy-duty investigation, though, in terms of getting search warrants, going to Willits, going through your house, looking for nails, looking for bomb materials. I think there are two separate occasions when they went through it with a fine-tooth comb.
Yeah, in fact, the second one was even more outrageous than the first. The first one, they came in right after the bombing, raided my house, and, you know, finding all, looking at, confiscating such things as my calendar and my children's birth certificates and I don't know what else, they just anything they could get their hands on, finding nothing to link me to a bomb, certainly. So a week after the bombing, a letter was received by the Press Democrat, by Mike Janella, from somebody calling themselves the Lord's Avenger, claiming credit for the bombing. And the Lord's Avenger claimed to be a fundamentalist extremist who was against me both for clinic defense I had done in Ukiah and also for my work in the forest. And so the Lord's Avenger described the bomb supposedly in exact detail, and therefore the FBI said, well, whoever wrote this letter had direct knowledge of the bombing. Incredibly, though, this was not used to exonerate me. I mean, you would think this would exonerate me. Instead, the FBI then concluded, well, since Judy is the only suspect, the Lord's Avenger must be her accomplice. And so the Lord's Avenger letter was the excuse for searching my house a second time. Interestingly, they didn't search Daryl's house. If they thought that it was my accomplice, I was unconscious in the hospital at the time and Daryl was out. Yet it was only my house that was searched in relation to the Lord's Avenger letter, and they made much headlines out of the fact that they were looking for a matching typewriter. They never mentioned that they didn't find one.
Yeah, they actually took typewriter keys or took the typewriter into custody, sent it to Washington. I know for many weeks we're hanging on because they said Washington is doing an examination of the typewriter.
And there wasn't anything that vaguely looked like the type, by the way. I mean, naked eye. You don't need to send this one to Washington. There was nothing that vaguely looked like the type.
Okay. All right. So that's the encapsulation. You got out of the hospital after, what, about 4 or 5 months and started rehabilitation and going on from there. Meanwhile, the investigation was still going on. They were investigating you, not doing much of anything else. You, somewhere along the line, then filed a lawsuit against them for not for infringing on your civil rights. What's the lawsuit about?
Well,
you sued them.
Yeah, I filed a lawsuit for false arrest, illegal search and seizure, and other civil rights violations that were caused by them arresting me for the bombing instead of investigating it. And then there's a second charge that's a First Amendment conspiracy charge. We're charging the FBI with conspiracy for a change. And what we're saying is that not only did they falsely arrest us, etc., but that the reason that they did this was to discredit us as activists, to sabotage our political activity, violating our right to free speech, because they were trying to discredit us as terrorists to prevent us from being able to speak freely and be heard and to organize nonviolent demonstrations. And this is the COINTELPRO charge. COINTELPRO was a program by J. Edgar Hoover in the 1970s to sabotage political groups by, to disrupt, misdirect, discredit, and neutralize political groups. It was a program used against the Black Panthers, American Indian movement, against Martin Luther King, against anti-war activists, anyone who challenged the status quo. This program, COINTELPRO, was declared illegal by a congressional investigation similar to the one we're seeking now. It was declared illegal in 1975, and the FBI officially disbanded it. What we're claiming in our lawsuit is that the FBI may not use the name COINTELPRO anymore, but the tactics of COINTELPRO are still being used.
With a little perspective here, you know, we're all born and raised to have the highest respect for the FBI and the government and the military, and everybody does things right, and all doubts are resolved in their favor. This was very similar. I mean, with the FBI, you think of the same thing, the Division of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF, Texas, investigation, cover-ups. I mean, about a worst-case scenario. Matter of fact, they want to break the thing up now, the ATF, and merge it with the FBI. So the FBI is made up of human beings. It's made up of bureaucrats, government employees. Sometimes they get off track, and sometimes they have to be skewed back on track. Remember that the press is watching, the public is watching, and when you
the
do this kind of stuff...
The press helped frame me. The press didn't help. The press printed everything the FBI said, no matter how unreasonable it was.
The press is watching now and trying to put pressure on, you know, wherever it can, through Hamburg or whatever. But anyway, you filed the lawsuit against them, against the FBI. Now, one of the things I think it needs to be brought out is that ContelPro that you were just saying about, that was popular with Hoover, was set up to mess with the heads and disorganize the social activists, political activists of the 60s, was declared illegal by Congress in 75 and was disbanded. However, the guy that was in charge of that was sent to San Francisco, was head of the FBI office in San Francisco, and was the person in charge of your bombing investigation.
Well, he wasn't the person. He was a person. He was one of the people. He was one of, his name is Richard Held, and he was one of the principal architects of COINTELPRO. And he was directly involved in the framing and jailing of Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt and also of Leonard Peltier. So he has a very long history of using false information, threats, assassinations, and framings to try to stop political activists. So, yeah, this certainly is consistent with Richard Held's history. Richard Held personally went on television and said that not only were Daryl and I suspects in the bombing, but we were the only suspects. And the other thing about Richard Held is that when we announced that we had, we'll get to this a little while later, that we've gotten hold through our lawsuit of photographs that really clearly show that the FBI lied and knew it when they arrested me. When we announced that we had these photographs and we announced that we were going to go public with them, the same day that we made that announcement, Richard Held resigned, just as the head of the ATF resigned when they announced that that report was coming up. Richard Held didn't draw any connection between the two. He said he was resigning because he didn't want to move his family and didn't want to transfer, and he was going to go into private industry and work for the fraud division of the Visa company. And certainly fraud is an appropriate place for Richard Held, but you know, the scenario of us waving incriminating photographs on his doorstep while he cleans out his desk to leave upstairs is hard to ignore.
Okay, I would ask this admonition, though. The comments that we've made about him are him as a public official operating in a public capacity in a very, very public event. I would request that we not make any comments about him as a private citizen or anything that he's done since then. So this is, you know, just...
I don't know anything he's done since then.
Okay, so now let's get back. You have filed the lawsuit, and you survived several challenges by the government to get it thrown out of court. They moved to have it dismissed. They stated their reasons. The judge had a hearing. Dennis Cunningham represented you in the case, and the judge ruled that there was enough to keep going. It did survive the motion to dismiss. And then, since then, what has happened?
Well, then the next stage in a lawsuit is the right of discovery, where each side is allowed to gain access to information about the case from the other side. So we, by the way, the FBI appealed the motion to dismiss, and we haven't gotten past their appeal yet. It hasn't been heard. It's been over a year, and they haven't even set a court date. So we don't yet have access to the FBI files. That's why we have to go through the Congress for that. But the Oakland police did not appeal the motion to dismiss. They decided to go forward with the case. And that meant that we had the right to request their files and their police reports, which we did. And to my surprise, we got back 300 photographs and 270 pages of police reports that really indicted the police for mishandling this case. And I was surprised at the strength of the stuff. I was surprised that they gave it to us. You know, I would have expected them to shred it. So, but at any rate, what we got back was a series of photographs that showed, well, back up a little bit, when I was arrested, when Daryl and I were arrested, the police said, it's on the arrest warrant, that the reason why they thought it was our bomb instead of that it was a bomb that was meant to kill me, the reason that they thought it was our bomb because they said it was on the backseat floorboard, therefore we should have seen it, and so we knew we were carrying it and we were just transporting this bomb. But when we got the photographs, they showed not only that it's clear as day that the hole, there's this giant hole in the floor of my car right under the car seat. The metal curls back from the epicenter. There's no mistaking where it is. The frame of the car is buckled under the front seat. The back seat is completely intact. The front seat is blown through. No reasonable person could have made that mistake to accidentally think it was in the back seat. We also have police reports that went along with it. It showed that the first Oakland cop on the scene said that the bomb damage was under the front seat. Very shortly thereafter, the FBI arrived, and we, within 20 minutes, were identified in the police reports as being associated with Earth First and power lines dropping in Santa Cruz and Arizona and attacks on nuclear power plants and all kinds of exaggerated, ridiculous things that we had nothing to do with. At that point, they began to change the story about where the bomb was. And the evening of the bombing, at 7 o'clock that evening, the bomb went off about noon, the FBI held a briefing with the Oakland police. And the Oakland police reports reflect that FBI Special Agent Frank Doyle, their 20-year bomb expert, briefed the Oakland police on the known components of the bomb, including the fact that it was in the back seat. And I think this is evidence of conspiracy, and I think it's evidence of the FBI instructing the Oakland police essentially to lie. Now, all the Oakland police may not have known that they were lying, but ones in the photograph that I have photographs of Oakland police looking at this car, they knew that this wasn't true. And the man who signed the arrest warrant was named Sergeant Chenault from the Oakland police, and he used a very interesting construction in his wording. He said, "I viewed the white Subaru along with agents of the FBI. The FBI agent told me that the bomb was in the back seat." Well, he's looking at the car himself. He can see the back seat intact, and yet he's repeating this. And then he laid it all on the FBI. He says, you know, Frank Doyle says he observed a large hole in the back seat. The photos show that the large hole is in the front seat. So, you know, these are some pretty strong things, I think, that indict them. And this is how we got the attention of the congressional committee to look into it. When we released these photos, the other thing that happened besides Richard Held resigning is that the FBI announced that they were closing the case on the bombing. They said they're ending the investigation, that they have no more leads to follow, and so case closed. And not only have they never prosecuted me or Daryl, they've never seriously considered any other suspects. We responded that this isn't true at all, that they do indeed have leads to follow, but that the leads lead to FBI and police, and that's why they haven't. And we submitted two of these leads to the congressional committee. And the two leads that the FBI refused to investigate that we handed them, one of which is that one of the death threats that I got right before the bombing in April of 1990 was typed on the same typewriter and in a matching style as a police informant letter that was sent to the Ukiah police about me in 1988. And the police informant letter exaggerated my activities to try to make it look like I was a terrorist. And, you know, it was actually, I know who wrote that letter from what's in it. I could tell from what's in it who wrote it. And we publicly handed these two matching documents to the FBI, stated that they were matching, that I believed I knew who wrote them, and they have refused to investigate it. So that's, now what that says is that somebody who sent me a death threat was also a police informant. And I don't know if that person was working for the FBI, but they must have been working for somebody or they wouldn't have been doing this. And I think the FBI's refusal to investigate forensic evidence like matching documents is very telling. The second piece of evidence that the FBI refused to investigate that I sent to the congressional committee, though I think may be even more serious, and this concerns the Lord's Avenger letter. So the Lord's Avenger letter, as I said before, was written supposedly from a fundamentalist claiming to have direct knowledge of the bombing and describing both the bomb in my car and a similar bomb at the Cloverdale LT mill, describing these bombs supposedly in exact detail. But the Lord's Avenger didn't describe the bomb in exact detail. He made a mistake. He said that the bomb at Cloverdale was a 1.5-inch pipe, and the Sonoma County Police report said it was a 2-inch pipe. And we didn't know who was right, the Lord's Avenger or the Sonoma County Police, until we got these reports back from Oakland. And they included a photograph of the actual Cloverdale bomb, which didn't explode. It was intact. And from that photograph, it's quite clear that it is a 2-inch pipe, that the Lord's Avenger was wrong when he described it. And the FBI never noted this mistake. But the other thing that we discovered is that the 1.5-inch mistake appeared in one other document. It appears in an FBI lab report description of the Cloverdale bomb that we got through this discovery process. So not only did the Lord's Avenger make a mistake describing the bomb, but this mistake is repeated in the FBI report. That says one of two things to me. That says that either the Lord's Avenger wrote his letter from confidential police reports instead of from direct knowledge of the bomb, or that the FBI falsified their reports to preserve the credibility of the Lord's Avenger. And either of those two things implicate the FBI with being involved with the Lord's Avenger in creating or preserving false leads. And I think that's a very serious charge. It's not inconsistent with Richard Held's history, but those are the things that we sent to the Congressional Committee to bring their attention to this case.
Okay, and so they are pursuing forward. We'll be looking at those photographs an hour from now on Channel 3. Once again, there's a rally for civil rights today at noon in front of the Sheriff's Department, 589 Lograp Road in Ukiah. Again, we've had some calls. It is at the Sheriff's Department in Ukiah. It's not on the coast, and that's at noon today. Various sponsors, including Earth First, but basically all people of color, environmental activists, Spanish-speaking peoples from Native Americans. We interviewed Marjean McGee, one of the organizers of the rally. She was calling from the Pinole Reservation, Native American Reservation, north of Ukiah. We'll be getting a report from her tomorrow morning at 8:30 as to what went on. We did try and get a hold of Sheriff Tussaud. He is at a meeting in Covelo. We also attempted to get a statement from anybody acting in a spokesperson capacity on behalf of the Sheriff Department. They indicated they did not have enough notice in order to respond. Hopefully we'll have somebody from the Sheriff's Department tomorrow. If not, we'll be scheduling an interview with Sheriff Tussaud on the whole idea of Native American justice and the handling of Native Americans and the issue of racial prejudice. We'll also be interviewing additional aspects of this from the Native American community. I think something like that is definitely an outrage we want to expose, we want to educate, we want to treat as responsibly as possible, all within the context of all things considered. I am surprised that, Sheriff Tussaud has had a pretty good reputation as far as I'm concerned. A lot of people have supported him and continue to do so. He's usually been pretty fair, given the fact sheriffs are sheriffs. So that's it for today. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of staff and management at KMFB, KPMO, Anderson Broadcasting. Everyone's opinions are their own. Delaney tomorrow from the District Attorney's Office on asset forfeiture, the new law there, and then Bruce Anderson will be here in the studios. Again, Judy Berry live at 11 o'clock, playing back over the weekend.
Something happening here, what it is ain't exactly clear.